I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Venerable Lama Losang Samten. He is a teacher of Tibetan Buddhism. He is the author of the book Ancient Teachings in Modern Times, Buddhism in the 21st Century. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So let's talk about Buddhism. This is a book, Ancient Teachings in Modern Times, Buddhism in the 20th Century, written for people who aren't necessarily Buddhists, maybe who are beginners or who are interested in this. So let's talk about some of the basics. Some of the key concepts of Buddhism that you write about are nonviolence and interdependence. Talk about the meaning of each one of those.
Well, those two are those highly emphasized in the Buddhism and Buddhist tradition. Buddha taught those two are such a very highly. And also today as in the world today, really it's sort of so important to people to understand and to see the value of it, how important the nonviolence, how much we come through in 20th centuries, how many people lost in 20th centuries, over 200 million people killed by the people. So it's so important to us to promote the nonviolence.
200 million people killed in the 20th century by each other.
That's right. So because of that, it's so important to us, such a living as a one family today, living condition, the food, the things we wear, things we eat, all of such a living as interdependent. Me living in here in the United States, things I eat come from some other countries. I grew up in India. I can eat, I'm living in the United States, but I can eat every day the rice which grow from India. It shows about how important to understand we're interdependent. And so these things are not only reminding ourselves, but we need to promote, to teach the younger generation and teach the people. Teaching and promoting this kind of value, hopefully we'll reach to the, you know, living more peacefully, more understanding, more respect to each other.
I always try to understand concepts that are maybe difficult or that are new or whatever through metaphors of nature. And in nature and in science, we certainly have interdependence because we understand ecosystems as interdependent within themselves. Is that the same concept as Tibetan interdependence?
Same concept, yes. I mean, interdependence has many different levels of it, but basically the same thing as you explained. It's the same thing.
And so what is so striking to me is that interdependence is something we can understand through concepts that we already have here in the West, scientific concepts, but nonviolence is something that's really not something you can look to nature for. Nature is full of violence. Everybody, in order to eat, kills something else pretty much. And so nature is tremendously violent. And so where does nonviolence come from?
Nonviolence comes from to how nonviolence and the violence comes from something from our mind or our thoughts. So the thoughts produce the violence, thoughts produce nonviolence. So even though we're living with so much things, we are, for example, we're eating any meal, of course they will have to do with a lot of violence, killing a lot of insects, things like that. But here I'm more promoting or talking about nonviolence, about how much we're hurting each other. For example, we're living with a dinner table, how we can live with the nonviolence before we say something in the world from our mouth on that table. We need to think about, is that appropriate to say? Make sure that doesn't hurt others' feelings. So there's many different ways to look at it, living as a nonviolence.
So it's not just physical violence, it's verbal violence and things like that.
Definitely, yes. I mean, that's why in Buddhist tradition, teach so many of how to tame the mind, all the Buddhist teachings, all the major religions teach about how to live with more peace. More peace doesn't mean only physical sort of like a putting into some sort of physically into the cave, but mainly how to live with mentally, to how to be kind to each other, how to be more respect to each other. So mainly dealing with the mind rather than too much physical thing. But physical things to depend on the mind, so that's why it's so important. That's why I say so much things in this book about how important that is.
When you talk about not hurting other people's feelings and so on, there's a whole list of, I think you call them non-virtues in Buddhism, and they include things like not killing and stealing and lying, gossiping, not using harsh words, divisive speech, not coveting. And I wondered, how are these similar to or dissimilar to the idea of sin in Christian thinking?
Well, there is a similarities and also there's the differences there. Yes, of course, the similarity is these things are both the religion talks about these are the things we shouldn't do it. If it does that, that doesn't look good for you or in the society. But the differences is, in Buddhist point of view, these are not created by somebody else. This is created by you, not created by the God, not created by some sort of external force, but it created by your own mind.
So in a way, it's a really different thing, because with sin, it's all actions.
Right.
And if you don't do the actions, then you're good.
That's right.
But if you don't do the actions, but you want to do them,
that's
and you
right.
refrain from doing them forcefully,
that's right.
then
right.
you're still not committing sin. But in Buddhism, it's a whole different thing, because when these things are racing around in your mind, the desire to hurt somebody or whatever,
that's right.
even if you don't do it,
mm-hmm.
you need to take an action to clear those, I guess, what do you call them, poisons?
The poisons or the negative karmas?
Yeah.
Yes. By the way, you know, one thing is a major religions are very much, there is so much similarities, which I don't know that in the 20, 30 years ago, before I came to United, one of the reasons I came to United States in 1988, one thing is I do a lot of Zen mandalas. I've been doing it also in Santa Fe a few times in the past, and Albuquerque and all over the related country over 20 years. And personally, the reason I came for that in that project 1988 in American Museum of Natural History in New York, Mandala Project. But personal reason is I would like to study more depth of Christianity and Judaism. So more I study that, how I see as a, how much there's a similarities. It's such a wonderful thing.
What do you see as the similarities?
Similarity is all the teachings of Jesus. Basically, his teaching is about how to be better human being, how to be better citizen of that country, how to be control the negative emotions. And here we Buddhism call it like a three poisons, three difficulties. For example, the anger is the one, and greed is the one, and the last one is the ignorance. These three emotions are really the causes of suffering. So in Jesus says the same thing, the anger is really it causes the suffering in our humanity. So more I study for the other major religions, it shows how similarity about all the teachings are.
There was something in the beginning of your book which I found so interesting. You were born in Tibet and then you escaped to India, and you spent much of your life in India, your childhood, and loved India. And one of the things that you saw is that people in India, they can get very angry at each other, but they tend to let it go. And so they're fighting in the morning, and in the afternoon they're drinking tea together.
That's right.
And to American sensibilities, we're so different from that. I think we have a cultural tendency to keep anger for as long as we possibly can.
I see that. Yes. You know, that also, that really to, you know, so many people see that, and I saw that too. And the Indians really love them dearly. And not only the Indian government are so important for us, for Tibet and Tibetans, especially the Tibetan refugees since 1959, and they give us a home, a second home in their land. In a way, you know, we Tibetans also, over the 22,000 years, we preserve their culture, which is Buddhism, from India. So there is some sort of very important relationship, not just 1 year or 1 century, but over 2,000 something years. So the Indians have exactly what you said. I said also book two. Yeah, you know, I see that often in when I traveled all over the India. So they mad at each other and they're fighting, and a minute later they're sitting together on the chair and having tea together, and that really says something to me. I learned that so much, and how wonderful that is. So based on that, in one of my teachers, he always says that we all have anger, but we try to not to stay too long in that environment. So I see that as an example.
How do they learn that? I mean, do they teach that to their children? Is it culturally reinforced?
I think culturally, you know, a lot of things, even though we all have the same human being, but sometimes it depends on the culture-wise. We eat differently, we have a different clothes, costumes, or clothing styles. And so the culturally sometimes is that makes a differences. But also the same thing like a lot of Tibetans who I really admire so much. I'm not talking about something Tibetan who have a big title or the name of the lamas and tukus and like His Holiness Dalai Lama. I'm talking about just ordinary Tibetans who probably number living in here in Santa Fe, in New Mexico, for example. Especially the older generation. We lost our country. Majority of their family died under the Chinese the rule in Tibet, and been to in prison so many years, but not necessarily they don't have a tremendous anger toward the Chinese. So that is such a remarkable. I've seen that for them, and I wish we Tibetan younger generation should learn that, really the culture, and wish that we can preserve that.
Well, you tell a story in the book of somebody named Thubten Chokten, who was a teacher who tried to escape from Tibet, and he was caught, and he was put in Chinese prison, and he was there for over 2 decades, and they gave him an extra long sentence because he was a teacher. And when he got out, he said something that was so amazing to me. He said that his biggest fear when he was in prison, and it was a horrible labor camp, and they treated him horribly, was that he would lose his sense of loving kindness toward his captors.
Very true.
Really. I mean, we lose our loving kindness when we go through the TSA airport security line.
Understand. So there's a lot of good, beautiful examples. For example, just about, you know, that was true, the Thubten Chokten. He's still alive. He's in Dharamsala. He came out of Tibet, luckily. And in living still in Dharamsala, home of his master Dalai Lama, I see him as such a role model, one of the Tibetans. But there's many of it. I mean, this is just I heard from him. But there's so many Tibetans even today, are such a great role model. To these the stories, which we can learn in the humanities.
Well, they're great role models, and I keep wondering how they get that way. In other words, do their mothers and fathers teach them that? Do they learn that in the process of meditation and spiritual practice?
Both. One thing is in Tibetan in community, I'm sure here in Santa Fe, in Albuquerque, the Tibetans, I hope they're doing the same thing. We teach in the family, in the kids, how to be kind, how to live with the more humble, how important others' life, not only your life, how important others' lives are. And everybody's life is a precious. Not only you and your families are precious, but everybody's are precious human beings. So respect. And so that sort of young age, training in the family. And then plus the person, him or her, have a chance to go to the monastery. The main thing they teach is how to be better human being, which means to how to control the anger, how to control the negative thoughts to yourself and the other. So that's a really what I see today, or when I, you know, see things in Tibetan history today, how much the Buddhist teachings have shaped the whole Tibetan, you know, way of thinking.
We're talking to Venerable Lama Losang Samten. When you talk about in the United States, sort of pop psychology, controlling your anger, some people would say, well, don't repress your anger, let it out. So it's a very different way of thinking. How do you control your anger in the Tibetan way, in the Buddhist way, without repressing it?
That's a good point. That also comes quite often questions when I teach Buddhism in everywhere. But I said like this, it's important to express. You know, sometimes we Tibetans, sometimes personal, sort of like a personal feelings are, sometimes we are sort of not expressing right away. That kind of sometimes I see as difficulties. But the key thing is, I put an example in the house, if there's some sort of like in the rain, and then on the roof there's some sort of dripping the water. So the dripping the water, and we need to put the basket or bucket on the, or not damaging the floor. So the putting the bucket is like expressing the feelings. But the deep down, we need to look at where's the really the water is coming from. So we cannot put whole our life to bucket after bucket. So somehow we need to look at what really the root of that feeling is. So that's the case. So the spiritual teaching they teach about the root of the suffering is some sort of really deep down, either rather due to the anger or the hero, especially the ignorant, not didn't see the realities. So that's really the Buddhist whole teachings about.
When you talk about anger or ignorance or greed, but let's stay with anger for a moment. Somebody is angry because they feel they've been wronged by somebody else, or somebody is angry because of things that are real. I mean, things that are wrong, like social injustice.
Exactly.
I mean, I can't imagine how the Tibetans aren't angry at the Chinese, but that kind of example, or racism in America and people being mistreated because of the color of their skin. So forgiving, I mean, what do you do with that?
That's a really, we all have that. But the thing is, we need to look as not only the Buddhist tradition, but lots of tradition talks about this. But the key, deep down, we need to look at what anger does for us. If somebody did something wrong with us, if our anger help to solve the problem, then why not? But the deep down, anger is damaging ourselves. Anger damaging our health, our personal health. Anger damaging our sleep. Anger damaging about losing our appetites. So many of things. So because of that, anger is not necessarily good.
And so in cases where it does help to solve a problem, then it's okay?
Yeah, if the anger helps to solve the problem in our humanity, why not we show all anger? Let's we all express our anger. So it doesn't do that.
It's tricky business, though, because so much of the time it leads to violence in word or in action.
Right, that's true. But, you know, things is like when we look at I love history. One of the channel in television, I watch the History Channel in a way. So when I watch History Channel, so I seen that how anger is damaging the society and things like that. So many ways we all in a way the Buddhists teach about the freedom, free thoughts, not necessarily believe somebody said, but you the person have a fully power or try to investigate it. Investigate it and reinvestigate it, and whatever he or she found the right, and then believe it. So rather than say, well, anger is bad because it's said by Dalai Lama, anger is bad because it's said by the Jesus, that's not good enough. But you, the person, individual case, investigate it very scientifically. So he's today, I mean, His Holiness is encouraging for the Tibetans and have so much conferences about the Buddhism and the science, and Buddhist science and the Western sciences. So it's investigating about things about the anger, how for also things like kindness, compassion. The kindness, compassion, the child received the kindness, compassion from the parents at a young age. Him or her grown up differently. Him or her react differently. Him or her really does differently. So that young age, if he or her doesn't receive the kind, compassion treatment with so much violence, so much fight among the family, that's why, because of so much problem. So it shows there the link. And not necessarily we're talking about the rebirth or nirvana, enlightenment, but the day-to-day basis.
Let's talk for a moment about karma. That's a word that everybody uses.
That's right.
And I guess it is much more subtle and difficult to understand
than
we think.
That's right. Right. That's very true. I said that also in the right beginning of the chapter of the karma. The karma means cause and effects. Karma means basically, my karma is a very depth of a subject, but also how I look at it is, you know, if you do good, there's a good result. If you do bad, there's a bad result. So it's a way today is a, you know, a little cold because of weather and snow and cold. That's just sort of really like a way right there. So it's a cause and effects. So that's the overall what the karma means.
And yet it's hard to understand in our lives because there are so many people who do good things and have horrible luck. And there are people who do absolutely horrible things and they live in glorious mansions and
true, very true. But I look at it like this though. Some of the results can be right there, we can see it, but some of the results it take a little time. So I look at it, even though we've been going through so much, I said that in my book too. I asked that many times. The Tibetans, generally speaking, really, we are kind people. We are really kind people.
So what and you ever so do to deserve the
I child? Know. So, I mean, what we're going through, what we've gone through about the whole country, and still now, and so much difficulties Tibetans in Tibet. So I asked that myself, why this is happening? But so then some sort of rather right or wrong, I felt that while this can be, I cannot solve the problem. I cannot puzzle, understand at the moment, but there must be have some sort of a result. You know, so there must have a cause and effects. So even though I didn't see in the right way the result of it, but sooner or later, hopefully, sooner or later, it is achievable. It is a really, that's like, for example, the monk, the Thubten Chokten story. He gone through so much difficulties. He been in prison 20 years, but still we talks about his kindness, his tolerance, his compassion toward the Chinese. I'm sure any of Chinese read that story, I'm sure he or she felt something very fascinating, rather than shown to the anger to the Tibetans. So it's slowly, one by one individual and at a time to change their way of thinking. So for example, about a couple of weeks ago in Philadelphia, every year there's one school in charter school in Chinatown in Philadelphia. They always invite me around this time of the year, and me, Tibetan, their majority of Chinese students, different age, but I talks about the kindness, compassion. So there's something I always anxious to go to visit their school, because of there's no differences. We all are same human being. You know, so we're putting the whatever you know thinking about. I'm not, when I go into that school, I took over my mask. I took over my like a cover of. I'm not thinking of myself. I'm Tibetan. They are the Chinese. I'm thinking of myself. We all are same human being. So that way, so much easier to, you know, communicate. There's so much genuine caring and understanding each other.
We're talking to Venerable Lama Losang Samten. You talk about, and I've read often, that Buddhism considers itself not really a religion, but a practice not based on faith, but on basically reason and testing these things against your own experience. You don't have to believe anything. Is there a role for faith in Buddhist practice?
There is a faith, but the faith should come from the reason, not just the faith. So Buddha said that, don't believe because of what I said, but you need to investigate. So that shows a huge door for the follow the Buddhism. So Buddhism is a base, you know, the culture-wise, there's some Buddhist merit, or some Buddhists, they call up Buddhists, but also similar beliefs, sort of like a lots of faith, but not really a study. That kind of a Buddhist there too. But the real Buddhist tradition is not based on the faith, but based on the logic.
On logic, and so we've had different Tibetan Buddhists on the air on this program who talk about how there's a part of the day in the monastery which is devoted to debate and discussion.
That's right. In the debate, I said to really, you know, it's true. During the debate, not only during the debate, or any time of the debates, you can say anything, you know. No one thinks you are not respectful for the Buddha Dharma. No one thinks about your disrespect to the Buddha or His Holiness the Dalai Lama. But you need some sort of background, you know, the logic, you know. You cannot just, you know, say anything just screaming there, but you, the person, he or she need some sort of reasoning, and then person who he or she will debate for you, putting the reasoning, who has a more background of the reason. So the base, the logic is so important. So that's why the Tibetan Buddhism is, His Holiness quite often saying, this is came from India, special Nalanda tradition, which means in India, in Nalanda University, around 7th, 8th centuries, the whole Buddhist study is based on the logic. So that for my case, Lobsang Samden, I have a privilege to go into His Holiness the Dalai Lama's monastery. So I've been studying a Buddhist philosophy with the logic over 15 years. So I'm saying that because I know this. I'm not saying that some sort of like a proving Buddhism or logic. No, but I said that's how we learn. That's what they teach you. That's what they, you know, they will teach you more about bringing more questions. They will encouraging you more doubts. They're encouraging you more questions. And no one says in the school, you should believe this, otherwise you are not good Buddhist. No, that's not how tradition is in this tradition.
Why is it then that everybody comes to the same conclusions?
Because the truth is the one.
But is there really, I mean, this is the thing that I always wonder about. I mean, people are so fundamentally different from one another in a lot of ways. I mean, there's some maybe psychological similarities and so on, but I know people who've been raised in very religious families, and they just search deep inside themselves, and they're atheists. And I know people who've been raised in atheist families, and they grow up, and they search within themselves, and they're religious.
Right.
And they're just, people are so different, so why would there not be multiple truths for all the different kinds of people there are?
Actually, there is a multiple truth, says, in the Buddhism tradition, yes. There's not only one truth, so. In the Buddhism, basically, you know, let's say look at it, loving kindness, compassion, and interdependent, or the view, or the Buddhist view. So, loving kindness, compassion, aspect of among the Buddhism, there's not much debate. Everybody thinks that's a good thing. But come down to the view or the reality aspect of it, there is a huge debate. Each school have a different point of view about what the truth is. Yeah, there is so many different varieties of Buddhist schools. One thing is in ancient time, there's four Buddhist tenets. Each school have a different point of view what the realities are. So there's so many different views there, yes. Not everybody agree on one thing.
So the only thing they really agree on is loving kindness?
That is in loving kindness, compassion for yourself, loving kindness, compassion. Even loving kindness, compassion case also they debate too. For example, that's the two yanas is, Hinayana and Mahayana. Hinayana teach promoting loving kindness, compassion for yourself. For their case, loving kindness, compassion for the all sentient beings is for them is a big debate. So the Mahayana point of view, the loving kindness, compassion for the all living being, all sentient being, it for them is a right. Even that the case, loving kindness, compassion has also debate. So it is, of course, there's a lot of debate because of so that's why the Buddha taught teaching so many different level of teachings, because of we all have a different understanding of it, different way of thinking, different way of, sort of capacity to understand so many levels of them.
And I suppose that your ability to understand these teachings goes hand in hand with the amount of practice that you do. And again, that's something we don't have a quick understanding of in what is basically an intellectual tradition, which
that's
is the
right.
Western tradition.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really, for example, related to that question, 15 years ago, I took a small group who researching about the brain wave, EEG or something like that, right?
Yeah.
So they would like to research some of the meditator in India. So we set up the place and we bring the meditators, hook up all the machines for them, and they're seeing the differences in the computer when they're meditating, when they're not meditating. So the one meditator said that to us, the group and myself, it's good to study this, so important, we're all searching the one truth. But at the same time, the scientists cannot understand only the research, they should practice.
Yeah, exactly.
So I thought that was very true.
Well, it's interesting too, because there are people who are trying to use feedback mechanisms to put little things on your head so that
that's
you
true.
Can achieve a brain state that's just like yours that you worked 40 years to achieve. Is that possible? Is it possible to take a technological shortcut to achieve states of practice that you would otherwise have to work for many years to achieve?
I think many years to achieve. I truly believe many years to achieve. Yes, but through the technologies, through the science, the technology, we discover lots of things which we never discovered before. And but it was so wonderful. So that was, I'm saying earlier, so wonderful to see these days a lot of scientists are interesting about the Buddhist point of view, about the reality. But the deep down, dealing with the mind, which is a need to be a long, long, long research, long, long process through meditation. So it's not just through the technology, we will not, only the technology, we cannot solve the problem.
There are so many kinds of meditation, and you talk in your book about one kind, and I've practiced another kind, and somebody else practices a third kind, and how do we sort that out? I mean, is there, for example, I think, there's an analogy that comes to me with music. Like, there's certain kinds of music which I just love, and other kinds, even though I know they're good, I just am not interested.
That's
and
right.
There's an inner, what would you call it, magnetism towards
That's
certain
right.
kinds of music. Is there the same thing towards certain techniques of meditation?
Exactly. That's a link for the earlier we discussion. So Buddha taught in this tradition, taught so many different levels of meditation. So many different techniques of meditation. Some people just for the breathing exercise will be perfectly fine. some people breathing exercise is not, you know, sort of working good. So him or her need to do a walking meditation. It's as simple as that. But so that's why there's so many in Hinayana tradition, Mahayana tradition, Vajrayana tradition. There's so many, really. Buddhism is a huge subject. And when I teach or give a talk about the Buddhism, some of the schools and the universities, and beginning people don't know much Buddhism, which means they thought maybe Buddhism is just one book. No, there's thousands and thousands of books.
Thousands, and they're hard to read.
Yeah, I know. But some of it is really in the original language, in the Pali language, in the Sanskrit language, and then later on they translate into their own own languages, in Tibetan language, in Chinese language, in Korean language. So many scholars later on, not scholars just so they know the intellectually, but a great deep meditator, they wrote commentaries on the subject. So many books there. So many books explaining so many different techniques. So such a wonderful, it's like you're going to the huge market. So you have so many choices.
Right.
But the choices comes with the responsibility. You know, so which means we have that choice, you have that subject, but now what he or she need to do is a sustained continuity practice and will not rise. So that's I think sometimes in the, you know, my experiences teaching the Buddhism or the meditation in the West, some people come into the center or listen to the talk, they felt just within one session would be fix everything.
Yeah, right.
You know?
That's like I'm going to learn to play the guitar in one lesson.
That's right. So, for example, the musicians, the great musicians, they practice every single day. Anybody who want to be a genius, you need to practice every single day. Even just, you know, this is the holiday, so people like to lose the weight. You need to practice and practice and practice and practice, make a shape in the body. So anything takes a time, not just within 1 week, 1 month, 1 year. Sustained continuity. And then we see the result. The Buddhist results we're not talking about 2,600 years. Buddhist results, we're talking in the Buddhist book, especially Buddhism in ancient time, which I explained. We're seeing these days. We are seeing a people in today, in Tibetan community, in all over the place. Not only Buddhist faith, I said in the book in here, number of Christian monks and the nuns are such a remarkable meditation. So that's the, I see the wonderful, that all the teachings basically come together to how to produce better human beings.
And so this is the question that I always wonder and always come back to, because we're living in such very dangerous times, not only because of war, which has always been with us, but because of environmental destruction,
right,
which is so rapid and so insane. And you can certainly say that it's based on ignorance and greed.
Especially greed.
Mm-hmm. And it's also based on habit. We have the same habits and we don't want to change, or we don't how to change and things
that.
And so you've got a small and beautiful group of Tibetan monks and nuns who've learned to be very good human beings mm-hmm. through meditation. How does it then translate into the larger world and particularly in terms of, I mean, helping us to deal with this huge, huge problem, which is that we're essentially destroying ourselves.
I know. But the thing is like this, though. I know when we're looking up about the listen to the news or reading the paper, or so much happening in the world, so much happening in the United States, so much happening all over the places. But we shouldn't lose our hope. But one individual can change the one individual's way of thinking. So, you know, to my view, my understanding or view to the Christianity, for example, 12 years ago, I met a Benedictine monk, Father James, in Canada. And he was a solitary retreat 37 years. Not because of he lived in 37 years in the retreat, and I met personally. Meeting him, listening his talks, he changed my point of view about the world.
Really?
Yes.
How?
Well, it brings to me how similar and how important major religions are, how important to come together, study together, discuss together, and meet each other to learn something. So that's why I hope this Buddhism in the West, especially Tibetan Buddhism in the West, I hope and pray it doesn't have to individual changing into them should be a Buddhist. That's not the goal. That's not how it works. But I hope today to study, reading book like ancient teaching modern time, to hopefully increase their own faith, become more Christian, become more good Christian, good Jew, good Islam. So when I'm meeting the Father James, he helped to grow my own faith to the Buddha, helped from seeing the other faith, such like a Father James. And also, not only that, it's tremendous to me to respect to the Jesus, Mother Mary. And it's so the thing is, what I'm saying is we shouldn't lose our hope. I mean, there's so much problems, but we do what we can.
Right. Now, we're talking to Venerable Lama Losang Samten. How important is it for a person to have a teacher? Can they learn through attending lectures and attending meditation sessions, or do they really have to have a one-on-one relationship with a teacher?
It depends. I said in my book, there's a huge chapter I wrote in this book about the teacher. So teacher is important. When we choose one of our kids to send them to school, we look at who's the teaching there. We were researching about who are the teacher in that school, who are the teacher in that university. So that shows about if the teacher is not good, what we can learn. It is important. But it's not that important sometimes. Guru devotions and guru respects and guru these things and guru, that's depend on the individual's level. If someone really wanted to go depth of Buddhist meditation, yes, then you need to find the right guru, guru devotions, guru practices. But until that, to learn as learning as a lecture, come as today the talk, to just seeing what the Buddhist can, presenting to you to something helpful in your life.
One of the things I was thinking about as I was reading your book is that, I mean, you say in the beginning a lot of people turn towards spirituality when times are hard.
Yes.
And then when times are easy, they may not think about it, they may not feel that they need it.
That's true.
And when you look at the extremes of human experience, in a way, the times where you need a practice like this to control your mind, to tame your mind, the most is either when you're in a situation of extreme powerlessness or extreme power. Because we see how power corrupts people, and lack of power also really ruins people.
Very true. But what I'm saying is spiritual training, any kind of spiritual training, is always necessary. Either politicians, the business, or any level, the spiritual training, which means basically is to training the mind, be some sort of, we need to control the negative thoughts to yourself and the others. That is really a damage of the society. So become a good politician, for example. If he or she has really some sort of caring for the others, sooner or later, everybody give a vote for him or her. Sooner or later, whole community behind him or her. So if the person is drawn to just for the power, ego, interest, and then sooner or later people will find out, and especially these days, information is so fast. So even somebody caring yourself, the best practice you can do is the kindness, compassion. You be, it be really a good path.
The book is full of metaphors, and we can't go over all of them because we don't have very much time left, but that are very helpful to understanding the concepts that you're talking about. And this idea of taming the mind and the idea of the monkey mind. So especially, I mean, I can sort of relate to the monkey mind myself.
Me too.
A little creature bouncing around all over the place.
Yes, me too.
You can't tame a monkey. Monkeys are untamable. So
right.
How do you understand, like, give us a metaphor for what it means to tame the mind.
To tame the mind is, again, there can be many levels or many different ways to tame the mind. For example, when you're cooking in the kitchen, just cook. When you're talking to somebody, just talk. When you're listening to something, you just listen.
No multitasking.
That's right. So more you focus, more you just being there, that's such a wonderful gift. If you're talking to somebody with your friend for these holidays, when you listen, that's the best Christmas gift to him or her. So we don't have to buy so many things from the store. We need to give to each one. Be kind and be there, basically, just be. And so to tame the mind, there's a spiritual aspect of tame the mind, and day-to-day basis to tame the mind. So that's, I mean, just when we're cooking, we're just cooking. When we're eating, just eating.
It's so interesting because when you say that, I mean, when I'm walking or when I'm doing the dishes, I'm thinking, and that's when the best ideas happen.
Right.
So if I were to tame the mind, I wouldn't have any of my good ideas.
That's that's what we think that. But in a way, when we think just one, is that their power is much more powerful than a thing that 100 different things at the same time. As a student in the classroom, if he or she listened to what the teacher's teaching, he or she learned a lot better than thinking something else. So just being with the moment, being in the whatever we're doing at the moment, that's, I'm saying, one level of the how to tame the mind.
Venerable Lama Losang Samten is the author of the book Ancient Teachings in Modern Times, Buddhism in the 21st Century. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.